Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, April the 4th, 2018. We start with the news section. Dirty water. Scientists found trace levels of emerging contaminants in the Triangle's water. Does the DEQ have the resources to keep up with these elusive toxins? The Duke researchers, who discovered trace amounts of contaminants in water sources around the Triangle last year, think they may be closer to understanding where they're coming from. The potentially toxic contaminants known as perfluorinated chemicals, or PFCs, are known to be especially elusive and difficult to track. At a forum last month, sponsored by the Sierra Club and NC Central, Lee Ferguson, an environmental analytical chemist at Duke University, said that his team might have some ideas. In some cases, the chemicals could be coming from sewage that is recycled and used for agriculture. The repurposed sewage can flow into tributaries of larger bodies of water, and since wastewater treatment plants aren't accustomed to looking for these little-known compounds, they're not especially good at removing them from drinking water. In other cases, the chemicals could be carried through the rainwater or the air. Durham's Assistant Director of Water Management, Vicki Westbrook, announced that Durham's latest test showed low levels of PFCs in the water. However, Westbrook doesn't believe that they're coming from water runoff, but rather some sort of aerosolized deposit that's floating over when it rains, and it ends up there. Ferguson and his colleague, Heather Stapleton, collected water samples from various sources, including their home faucets last year. Most contained detectable levels of defluorinated organic chemicals referred to as PFOAs and PFOSs, which the Environmental Protection Agency says cause cancer, liver damage, and birth defects, among other possible health issues, at high enough levels. It's important to note that while Ferguson and Stapleton discovered these chemicals, they did so at levels well below what the EPA considers dangerous. However, the combined level of a broader range of chemicals collectively known as PFAs, for which the EPA has not yet written a health advisory, has substantially higher in Cary and Jordan Lake. Ferguson says that at least cause for further investigation. Rachel Monshine, a laboratory supervisor for the town of Cary, won't speculate on the source of the PFAs, but says that her team has been in touch with the scientists who discovered them. A great deal of attention has been paid to Gen X, a PFA that has recently discovered along the Cape Fear River, that created a supposedly safer alternative to its predecessors. Gen X was found emanating from the Fayetteville plant of Chemours, a spinoff of DuPont, that manufactures Teflon and other nonstick coatings. The chemicals had likely been discharging as a byproduct since the 1980s. The North Carolina State is exploring the effects of the contaminant on residents in the Wilmington area, where the chemical has been frequently detected in drinking water. Chemicals like PFOAs and PFAs are known as emerging contaminants because scientists have only recently developed the tools to identify them in water systems. Additionally, some of the substances are new. They've been created by manufacturers for a specific purpose, and it's difficult to keep track of them all. There are 85,000 chemicals used in commerce, according to the EPA's Chemical Substance Inventory, and that's not including the multitude of byproducts that they transform into when they escape into the environment. Meanwhile, only 65 pollutants, or groups of pollutants, have been labeled toxic under the Clean Water Act, and the EPA's has only ever banned 9 chemicals. Aaron Carey, the Coastal Programs Coordinator of the North Carolina chapter of the Sierra Club, says that disparity proves that there are lots of chemicals that regulatory agencies can't keep up with. The mix of chemicals that we're ingesting in our drinking water should be of the utmost concern because we have no idea how they interact with each other in the body or in the environment, Carey said. In a lot of cases, that health advisory level is a shot in the dark, and it is not based on hard evidence. It is not based on long-term studies of humans. Often they are animal studies and only partially released animal studies because these companies claim that the information or the data is proprietary. One potential problem, environmental advocates say, is that the State Department of Environment Quality might not have the resources to effectively tackle elusive contamination patterns such as those discovered in Jordan Lake. At a recent tour for state representatives of DEQ labs, DEQ officials insisted that their staff members were working tirelessly to track PFAs and PFOAs across North Carolina, but the lack of state funding was making their job increasingly difficult. The DEQ's involved in responsibilities, including the transfer of certain DEQ sections to other agencies, makes budget figures difficult to analyze. However, in 2009, the legislature appropriated more than $200 million to the DEQ's predecessor, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. By 2017, that number had dwindled to just over $77 million. In a blog post, Robin Smith, a former assistant secretary for the environment at DENR, wrote that those cuts have had lasting effects on the DEQ. About 30 administrative positions have been eliminated since 2015, and since 2009, three entire programs have been slashed. Although the State House unanimously approved a bill in January to allocate more than $2.3 million to the DEQ for the new mass spectrometer and for several scientists to operate the new equipment, the Senate didn't take up the matter in a special session. Senate Republicans argued that scientific equipment could instead be borrowed from local universities and that research expenditures should fall on the companies responsible for the pollution rather than on taxpayers. The bill will likely come up again when the legislature reconvenes next month for the short session. DEQ officials acknowledge that their recording data could also use improvements. In the short term, they rely on simple plastic buckets to collect rainwater for their research on PFAS. The department plans to improve its accuracy by purchasing 8 sophisticated rain collection tools, but each system costs roughly $6,500, and Kenmore's is only paying for half of them. The rest will fall on taxpayers. Ferguson stressed that, compared to other states, North Carolina already has great potential to be a leader in the field of emerging contaminant detection. After all, the discovery of Gen X would have never happened if North Carolina did not have superior research facilities in which to conduct experiments. But it's still difficult for scientists to screen for possible contaminants without knowing which chemicals they should be looking for. Duke researchers say that monitoring equipment along the Rhine River, which serves as a source of drinking water for more than 20 million Europeans, could be a source of inspiration. At the Rhine's monitoring station, scientists collect data on emerging contaminants every day in order to identify larger trends. Sophisticated alarm systems also notify analysts when the concentration of dangerous chemicals surpasses a particular threshold. Ferguson hopes to one day set up a similar system in North Carolina that could spot contaminants before they become a significant health issue, as in the case with Gen X. Gen X is one emergent contaminant, but we really should be thinking about this from a more holistic standpoint, Ferguson explained. So we propose the creation of what we would call the North Carolina Emergent Contaminant Observatory. That plan would bring together state, federal, and academic actors to conduct research into how to best remove emergent contaminants from water systems. Ferguson says his colleagues have already discussed the possibility with state legislators and members of the DEQ and the EPA. So far, they're all on board, he says. For now, though, Kerry of the Sierra Club remains skeptical. We've been disappointed and disheartened, and to a certain degree, people are angry that this seems to be a political vehicle at this point, she said. The one agency that has been put in charge of protecting our drinking water has been cut over the last 8 years. The next news article, Fits and Starts. Has District Attorney Roger Echols been enough of a reformer to satisfy Durham progressives? In his bid for a second term, Durham County District Attorney Roger Echols will face two challengers in the May 6th Democratic primary, including one who snagged an important endorsement from a powerful local political action committee. Last week, Santana DeBerry, the executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition, won the backing of the People's Alliance, PAC, in a close vote in which DeBerry's vision bested Echols' experience. Criminal defense attorney Daniel Meyer will also be on the ballot, though he didn't get much attention during the PA's endorsement forum. According to Tom Miller, a PAC coordinator, speakers were fairly evenly divided between DeBerry and Echols. Both sides were concerned about the same issues, but they disagreed over who was best suited to execute progressive policies once in office. DeBerry, whose supporters are excited by her fresh perspective and calls for reform, and Echols, whose supporters say is already instituting some of those ideas. Miller says a lot of attorneys, both defense and prosecutors, spoke in support of Echols. They noted that he took over a troubled office. The previous two DAs had been removed for misconduct, and pointed to the diversion and amnesty programs that he instituted as evidence that he was already moving in the direction that Barry's supporters want. It's Echols' policy to begin with the lightest sentence when negotiating plea deals. Some cases are referred to in the Religious Coalition for the Nonviolent Durham for Restorative Justice as a part of the defendant's sentence. In partnership with the Durham Innovation Team, the DA's office implemented an amnesty program that allowed people to apply by text or email to have their traffic records wiped clean and get their driver's licenses reinstated. Recently, representatives from the DA's office, the county jail, pretrial services, and the public defender's office began meeting weekly to review who was being held in jail on bail less than $5,000 and negotiate for a lower or unsecured bond. About 3 weeks ago, that list had been whittled down to zero, although it has fluctuated since, Echols says. Echols says that if reelected, his priorities wouldn't change. He would seek to strengthen the misdemeanor diversion program, which is only available to teens. But when it comes to bail reform, Echols says there's not much he can do. Under state law, judges and magistrates set bail based on guidelines written by judges, referred to as a bail schedule. He would support a change to state law eliminating cash bail as long as the public is not endangered. If I could pass that law myself and write the fiscal note and give the money, I would, he said. DeBerry, however, sees the DA's position as central to reform. She pledges to be a more outward-facing, transparent district attorney. DeBerry spent almost 7 years as a criminal defense attorney, but left to help people before they interacted with the courts. She went on to work for the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the State Department of Health and Human Services, the Self-Help Group. Black and brown people in Durham have been over-prosecuted and over-incarcerated for decades under different DAs, DeBerry said, which to her indicates the need for a new approach. I see the system differently than a career prosecutor. I see the heart of this community. I see all of the impacts over criminalization. DeBerry says she would convene a task force as a liaison to the community and craft a prosecutor policy grounded in the input it gathers. She's also stressing diversion for cases rooted in mental illness, poverty, and substance use by making fewer arrests to begin with, and she opposes the current bail schedule. I think we arrest too many people for too low-level felonies and misdemeanors, she said. Most of those people should be able to write themselves out of jail. There should be no bond because there was no indication that these people are dangerous to the community. DeBerry's PA supporters weren't dissuaded by news that her campaign website closely mirrored that of Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, who is being lauded for the reforms he's rolling out. They, like DeBerry's platform, and think prosecutors should be looking to Krasner as a model, Miller said. DeBerry denies copying and pasting the language in her platform, although some passages are identical. The assertions made on her behalf were more aspirational, Miller said. Meyer says voters who think Eccles hasn't done enough to reform the system should look to him as an alternative. A defense attorney for 16 years, Meyer says Eccles has taken some positive steps, but it's time to move forward more dramatically on some changes that better reflect what Durham stands for and what Durham pursues. He would expand the misdemeanor diversion program to include more low-income, victimless offenses, push for the bail schedule to be revised to recommend unsecured bonds for more offenses, and institute an amnesty program for people with outstanding warrants for failing to appear in courts. We think that a few days doesn't matter, but any time in jail is a lot, especially if you shouldn't be there, he said. Because no one from outside of the Democratic Party filed to run for the seat, the winner of the Democratic Party will be the county's district attorney. The next nurse article, Hogs Come Home. The first nuisance trial against pork giant Murphy Brown begins this week. For years, neighbors of some North Carolina hog farms have complained about the nauseating stench of hog waste that they say blankets the air around them. This week, they'll begin making that case to a jury. In a federal court in Raleigh, the first trial in a series of groundbreaking lawsuits against Murphy Brown, LLC, the world's largest pork producer, kicked off on Monday. The outcome could have major implication for the state's multi-billion-dollar pork industry and could force big changes to the way farms manage excrement. The 26 lawsuits were filed in 2014 by more than 500 plaintiffs living near industrial hog farms in eastern North Carolina. The plaintiffs argue that the farm's practice of storing hog waste in open-air cesspools and then liquefying and spraying the remains onto nearby fields has made their lives miserable. Among other things, they say that the odors and mist from the spray drift onto their property, that the hogs attract swarms of flies, buzzards, and gnats, that boxes filled with rotting dead hogs produce an especially pungent stink, and that the stench has limited their ability to go outside. The lawsuit claims that Murphy Brown's parent company, Smithfield Pumblewoods, which was purchased by the Chinese corporation WH Group in 2013 for an estimated $4.7 billion, has the financial resources to eliminate the odors, but has failed to do so negligently and improperly. The first trial concerns 10 plaintiffs who live near Kinlaw Farm in Bladen County, which, according to court records, contains 12 hog buildings and 3 open-air cesspools. The farm, which contracts with Murphy Brown to raise the company's hogs until they are processed, is not the subject of the litigation. Even so, industry advocates have argued that these lawsuits are an assault by avaricious attorneys on hard-working family farmers. North Carolina's hog farmers are under a coordinated attack by predatory lawyers, anti-farm activists, and their allies, Smithfield Foods told the Indy last year. The lawsuits are about one thing and one thing only, a money grab. According to their complaint, these 10 plaintiffs have suffered episodes of noxious and sickening odor, onslaughts of flies and pests, nausea, burning and watery eyes, stress, anger, worry, and loss of property value. Plaintiff Delois Lewis, according to the complaint, can no longer hang clothes out to dry because they will absorb the hog's odors. Archie Wright says he can occasionally hear the screams of hogs through the wooded areas that separates his home from the farm, and he can no longer open his windows to air out his home. His girlfriend, Teresa Lloyd, spends much time outside now than before, much less time than before. Although the plaintiffs take issue with the farm spray field system, Murphy Brown's attorney said in a court filing that jurors should not hear about alternative technology that farms outside of North Carolina use to dispose of hog waste because that would imply that such technologies could be implemented by Kinlaw Farm. The company's attorneys have also asked the court to exclude reference to Smithfield's Chinese ownership, as well as information about Murphy Brown lobbying and public relations activities, including on legislation such as House Bill 467, a bill passed last year that limited the amount of money people suing agriculture operations could collect in nuisance lawsuits. The trial is expected to last about 6 weeks. The next trial, which involves a new batch of plaintiffs, will be heard 2 weeks after the first trial ends. After that, trials will be held once a month until all the cases are decided or a settlement is reached, which means we could be doing this for a long while. The next segment... Full Frame, True Lies, How Docs Bend Reality to Get at His Heart. All decent journalists know that you can't just aim a recording device at reality and expect it to divulge the truth. You have to analyze, interpret, and present the information in such a way that its hidden inner workings and its invisible outer context are made clear, forming a choreography of storytelling in which truths below the surface can be glimpsed. Documentarians know the same secret. While some argue for the most dispassionate gaze, others aesthetically complicate or inject themselves into the stories they document in pursuit of truth beyond what the eye can see. By and large, those are the people we are highlighting in our preview of the 2018 Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, an annual institution that draws docs and filmmakers from around the world to Durham. We spoke with Joe Berlinger, the legendary Paradise Lost director and curator of Full Frame's True Crime program, about this groundbreaking infusion of dramatic fiction troupes into documentaries that achieved real-world results. We examine how Terrence Malick and Eugene Richards made two films, one fictional and one documentary, from the same footage. And we explore a unique skateboarding documentary in which one person is both director and subject. We also look at Owned, A Tale of Two Americas, a dark secret powered by the director's personal experience, and Capturing the Flag, an interesting view from the outside of voter suppression in North Carolina. This selection only scratches the surface of what's available in Full Frame. We highly recommend the tribute program to Egyptian-American filmmaker Jehan Nujaim, for example, but it gives an overview of the challenges, opportunities, and stakes for documentarians in an age of untrustworthy news. More than ever, you have to share the truth to make it true, and more than ever, you have to be careful and responsible in how you do it. True Detective. For Brother's Keeper and Paradise Lost director Joe Berlinger, true crime storytelling matters most when it gets real results. Director Joe Berlinger knows a thing or two about the power of true crime storytelling. His award-winning 1992 debut, The Brother's Keeper, about the alleged 1990 murder of William Ward in Munnsville, New York, challenged the way of documentaries are presented, their subjects. He followed it with Paradise Lost, which led the release of death row inmate Damien Eccles. In subsequent films, Berlinger has taken on Whitey Bulger, an Ohio serial killer, and the Chevron Corporation. His work delivers him to Durham for this year's Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, where he curated the festival's first true crime documentary program. The selections include three of his own films, as well as the likes of In Cold Blood, Scenes of a Crime, The Thin Blue Line, and Frederick Wiseman's 1967 Tinnicut Follies, which has only recently been made available in the United States. We stole a few moments from Berlinger's hectic schedule to discuss his selections, his influences, and the wide-open future of true crime storytelling. We also talked about the difference between true crime entertainment and public service convictions made or overturned. Conversation started, lives changed. The Indy question. Is this your first time at Full Frame? Have you curated your many film festival programs before? He answered, I'm a veteran. I've shown quite a few of my films there, and I'm thrilled when they ask me to do this. I'm a fan of Full Frame. I appreciate the fact that it's totally focused on documentaries. The screenings are always packed. There's always good conversation afterwards. I can't think of many festivals where they ask guest filmmakers to curate a thematic program. The next question. Your work has achieved canon status in the true crime documentary area. What was your gateway into this genre? Mine was the book Helter Skelter. He answered, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood kind of opened my eyes. That book gave birth to the true crime genre. It was influenced in how I wanted to go about making my true crime films because Capote was kind of inventing a new form of literature called the nonfiction novel. It was the first time that journalistic technique was blended with fictional narrative techniques. He was merging the form of the novel with a nonfiction story. I consider what I do the filmic equivalent of what Truman Capote was doing with the literature. Brother's Keeper was an early expression of that idea, not straightforward documentaries, which are like an illustrated lecture of some subject, but to infuse dramatic narrative qualities to them. The Indy went on, Your work often exposes how different interests attempt to shape narratives to fit their own purposes. How does that, and your overall view of crime and punishment, run throughout the selections that you've chosen for this program? He answered, I try to pick films that either had a deep influence on me or represent hallmarks in this genre. For example, Earl Morris's The Thin Blue Line. This was the first time a filmmaker used stylized recreations to tell a nonfiction story. Today, stylized recreations are very common, but Earl was the first to kind of open or redefine the envelope of what a documentary could be. Tinnicut Follies, which looks at a hospital for the criminally insane, is a hallmark film in cinematic verite. Brother's Keeper, my own film, a landmark in this kind of nonfiction feature film, which pushed the envelope with regard to style, with an evocative opening sequence which used an original score. Documentaries before them didn't use original music because people who made documentaries felt that you were manipulating how the audience should feel instead of being journalistic. I included one scripted film which is not a documentary, In Cold Blood. It was shot in 1967, a time when location shooting was not as common. Richard Brooks went to the real town to shoot the feature film. They shot the killings at the same house where the Clutter family was murdered. Can you imagine the actors shooting these scenes in the very house where the murders took place a few years earlier? 7 of the 12 jurors in the film were jurors on the actual case. There was such a push for authenticity that I found the film to be very compelling and influential in my development as a filmmaker. Next, the Indy asks, recently, you've taken your own shot at the Cold Blood story, right? He said, we did a series called Cold Blooded, which looks at the underlying crime itself and focuses more on the victims. One of the prices we paid with this explosion of true crime is that the focus is often the perpetrators of the crime. You remember the perpetrators rather than the victims. So my one criticism of In Cold Blood, both the book and the movie, is that it treats the Clutter family as a side note, and we as a society have kind of celebrated the perpetrators. Perry Smith and Dick Hancock became the cultural icons, even though they were murderers, and nobody really knew the Clutter family. The Indy went on, how did you choose which of your own films to include? He said, I felt uncomfortable choosing my own shows, so I gave that task to Full Frame Programming director Sadie Tillery. Paradise Lost rarely does a filmmaker have an opportunity to have a direct impact on a case. We made 3 films over 20 years, which led to the release of The West Memphis 3, and then Gone, The Women of Ohio. I think we pushed the envelope on what a TV investigation could be. This was a real-time serial killer investigation because, while it was unfolding, nobody knew who the killer or killers were. The parents of the victims felt like because their daughters were drug-addicted prostitutes, nobody cared or was paying attention to the crime. The police weren't taking it seriously. I felt everybody deserves justice. I'm going to mount my own investigation and do it with a camera rolling. That's the most out on a limb I've ever gone covering a story. The Indy? Lately, other platforms, especially podcasts, have become ubiquitous methods of true crime storytelling. What excites you about the future of the genre? He said, exactly what you said. I haven't announced it yet, so I can't give too many details, but I'm going to try my hand at a true crime podcast in the fall. There's such a proliferation of the way storytelling is today. It's a great time to be a storyteller. People are hungry for content, and there are all sorts of places to put your stuff. It makes me happy because I get lots of stories from the people in prison who saw Paradise Lost or one of my TV series who are claiming wrongful conviction or some other abuse of the system. And you can't make a feature documentary about everybody you get a letter from. But with all the interest in true crime in digital form, in short form, in podcast form, there's all sorts of ways of telling stories these days. The Indy goes on, what do you want people to take away from this program? That good storytelling can be combined with the social justice aspect and have positive results. Tinker Follies has a major impact. Despite being banned for 25 years, it opened people's eyes to what goes on inside those institutions. The Thin Blue Line got somebody out of prison. Paradise Lost got somebody out of prison. Liz Gorbis and Johnson Shacks, The Farm, opened people's eyes to what goes on in prisons. There's 2 kinds of true crime filmmaking. There's certain shows that wallows in the misery of victims and have no social justice component. It's just storytelling at the expense of the victim, and that's not the kind of filmmaking I want to do or admire. I always admire those true crime filmmakers who do something to expose an abuse, to reveal wrongful convictions, or some other aspect of the criminal justice system that needs to be told. And finally, is there one you wish you could have included that didn't make the cut? He said, it was hard to limit it to 8 films. I especially felt guilty that 3 of them were mine. There's a million other things. The Staircase, amazing. The Jinx, amazing. Making a Murderer. There's a lot of shining examples of the genre, both old and new, that I wish I could have included. But maybe they'll do a part 2 thing next year. True enough, same footage treated as fiction in Terrence Malick's To the Wonder and as a fact in Eugene Richards' Thy Kingdom Come forms a complete picture of faith and filmmaking. Eugene Richards' new documentary, Thy Kingdom Come, is one of the several films at full frame that engage with religious questions. Its origins lie in director Terrence Malick's To the Wonder, an experimental film that weaves together stories that demonstrate memory's witness to love, both divine and human, amid rural and urban landscapes. Drawing on Richard's background as a photojournalist concerned with poverty and racial issues in the American South, Malick hired him as the videographer for the film, but the director used only a sampling of Richard's extensive footage from Osage County, Oklahoma, finding the stories of the people of Bartlesville powerful enough to tell on their own. Richards acquired the rights to the interviews and compiled extended versions of them as a documentary short. Part of what makes Malick's storytelling unique is his employment of cinema verite, a style of filmmaking that incorporates improvisational camera use and sees the filmmaker as a participant observer in the reality at hand. Capturing life as it happens, with partly unedited dialogue, enhances verisimilitude. It challenges fictional filmmaking by mixing actors with non-actors and questions the parameters of the documentary with scripted elements. From this vantage, Richard filmed actor Javier Bardem in character as Father Quintana, having unscripted conversations with people in nursing homes, prisons, and hospitals. Bardem plays a priest who struggles to believe in the very thing that he represents to a local church. Making house calls to his parishioners, he wrestles with his faith amid extensive systematic brokenness, poverty, sickness, depression. Inevitably, he must practice the homely homilies he preaches. Love is not only a feeling, it is a duty. You shall love it. It is a command. You feel that it has died. It is perhaps waiting to be transformed into something higher. Malick uses Richard's footage to illustrate Father Quintana's spiritual evolution, how his vocation is illuminated by the handicapped, the old, the ill, and the impoverished. He is utterly transformed through the stories of strangers discovering the deeper meaning of loving one's neighbor. But Thy Kingdom Come approaches this footage from the perspective of the documentary. The film opens with Bardem stating, "Is this a true story?" "Yes, I would say so." "Is the priest a real priest?" "No, but it is as if they were waiting for him." Instead of fictional Father Quintana's conversation, Richard's film is about the real people the character sought to help, recovering drug addicts, the incarcerated, former Ku Klux Klan leaders. All have experienced hardship and suffering as the normal way of life. The film's title is taken from a line in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven," which is intrinsically a political statement embodying the compassion and love that transform communities. Perhaps Richard is proposing that it doesn't matter if Javier Bardem is a fictional priest, because what he is offering his cinematic parishioners is his undivided attention, listening and affirming their humanity as they are, with, to the wonder, Thy Kingdom Come completes a diptych of fictional and documentary filmmaking. But ultimately, both films are about the eminence of human presence, the iconic power of the human face. Sad but true. A dark look at the American suburbs' numbing design and racist underpinnings in Owned, A Tale of Two Americas. The irony is, I raised money to make this film by flipping two houses, Giorgio Angelini said, chuckling about Owned, A Tale of Two Americas, this documentary about the ugly side of the American housing industry, which has its own world premiere at Full Frame. A native of Houston, Angelini bought his first home in Durham when he was playing drums and bass in the Raleigh indie rock band The Rosebuds and touring with Brooklyn band Bishop Allen. But the financial crisis of the 2007 and 8 had a detrimental impact on the entire economy, including the concert and entertainment industry, and Angelini abandoned his musical pursuits to enroll in architectural school. In the middle of the crisis, it was an interesting time to be in architectural school, Angelini said. We were coming out of this Dubai period of excess, and the discipline itself was asking, what was the role of design and architecture in this post-recession world? All these ideas were ruminating in my head. Angelini received a graduate school grant to research the U.S. housing crisis. His project included photographing the Inland Empire region of Southern California. It was 5,000 square miles of centerless sprawl, basically nothing but suburban development and private construction, he remembers. You had these burned-down orange groves sitting alongside these half-built McMansions, a really post-apocalyptic look. I felt that there needed to be a bigger story told. In Owned, the bigger story revolves around a contrarian interpretation of the usually unassailable notion that home ownership is an essential element of the American dream. What the film is trying to say is that it's the double-edged sword, Angelini said. Owning a home is great, and it provides security, and if you do it the right way, it builds strong communities. It dictates where you go to school and your propensity to move up socioeconomically. But at the same time, if you let capital interests invade this utopian ideal and run amok, it can quickly become commoditized to the point that it becomes dangerous for society. Through the stark sights of abandoned construction projects and sweeping vistas, Angelini posits that the housing industry is an insatiable beast that subsists on the back of ultimately self-crippling economic culture. The idea of home had been reduced to the most efficient capitalistic desires, Angelini said. Instead of bushels of oranges, they decided the best land use was a collection of air-conditioned square feet. There was a lack of human intention. Where could you almost feel these markets printing out this landscape of homes? Owned is also, as its subtitle says, a tale of two Americas. In the 5 years he spent making the film, Angelina expanded his view into other planned development communities and read headlong into how racial and economic segregation is inextricably linked to middle-class suburbia after World War II. The original idea behind the film was rooted in the relationship between design and commoditization, Angelina says. It became very clear that I couldn't tell the story without telling the other side. The film goes to hollowed-out neighborhoods in Baltimore to locate the contemporary effects of decades of discriminatory housing practices and policies. White flight didn't happen by accident, Angelina says. It wasn't a self-selected, albeit racist, situation. It was very much encouraged by federal laws that were interpreted on the local levels in particularly bad ways. Owned is Angelini's first directorial effort, though he was executive producer in the feature film my friend Dahmer. The expansive subject matter is packed into the dense 82 minutes with a generous array of archival footage from news features and vintage advertisements to television programs, Archie Bunker grouses about African-American neighbors on All in the Family, and inequities of redlining are discussed on Good Times. Beyond mere entertainment, Angelina says, there's a narrative purpose behind these pop culture snapshots. I wanted the feel and pace of the film to be like if the American dream was a place you could inhabit, he said. I wanted to create the fever dream version of that. The next film, True Colors. Capturing the Flag takes a hard look at the ugly reality of voting in North Carolina. Capturing the Flag, an often infuriating documentary about voting suppression in North Carolina, climaxes in a hotel room in Cumberland County, where three exhausted election volunteers are sprawled on beds watching the 2016 returns come in on the television. Being liberals, who travel to the state from New York City, they are dismayed by what they're watching. One, Stephen Miller, is especially losing his stuff. What the hell are they voting for? He yells to no one in particular. For those of us who lived through that night with similar convulsions of horror and disbelief, watching that scene elicits something like post-traumatic stress. It's also a weird way to end a movie about voting rights in the Tar Heel State. After all, while Wisconsin's draconian voter ID law may have helped throw that state to Donald Trump, one analysis found that as many as 45,000 people there were deterred from voting in a state Trump won by fewer than 23,000 votes. North Carolina's similarly naked mask attempt at suppressing African-American voters never went into effect. The bottom line of 2016 was this. Clinton didn't excite voters, and Trump, as loath as he was, hit the royal flush, winning exactly the states he needed to win with the tiniest of margins, and that is how he got this bungling disaster of a presidency. But that's not to say the right to vote isn't endangered, or that there aren't active, ongoing efforts to disenfranchise minority. There are. Straight away, the film describes these efforts, starting with the Supreme Court 2013 Shelby v. Holder decision, which overturned part of the Voting Rights Act and opened up a Pandora's box for Republican states that wanted to make it harder for Democrats to vote. This manufactured, among other places, in North Carolina, which restricted Sunday voting and implemented a stricter voter ID law under Governor Pat McCrory. That law was later struck down by the courts, but by 2016, those efforts had solidified the state's reputation for antagonism to voting rights. This set up the backdrop for Capturing the Flag, which began a few days before the election. Laverne Barry, a Brooklyn entertainment lawyer, and her friend Miller and Claire Wright are planning to head to the center of the storm, North Carolina, to serve as election monitors for the Democratic Party. Director Anne DeMare says she first conceived of the story through Barry, who is doing work for one of the film's producers. Barry mentioned to the producer that she needed to get things wrapped up before the election because she had to do voting rights work. The producer's interest was piqued, and she called DeMare, who was intrigued. It wasn't a deliberate choice to focus on North Carolina, she said. It was just that this was where Barry was headed, and DeMare's cameras followed. What they found when they arrived in Fayetteville was a lot of confusion and frustration, less brazenly malicious attempts to block the view, at least at the precinct levels, than a bureaucratic mess that just so happened to disproportionately affect black voters. There were the 3,000 voters whose names were purged from the voting rolls just before the election, only to have them restored by a federal judge. There was the voter who was told she didn't appear on the rolls, even though she'd voted in the primary. There was another voter who was turned away three different polling stations, and yet another who learned that the DMV lost his paperwork, and yet another who was told to return with an ID even though the voter ID law had been struck down. There were shortened voting times and fewer polling stations, which meant longer lines and lots of conflicting information. The subtlety with which this kind of suppression happens is significant. It's not as stark as a poll tax or a literacy test. It's a lot of little things that can add up to a big thing. Voter suppression looks a lot different than it did in the 50s or 60s, DeMayer said. It's neglect, lack of funds, shifting legislation, a sense of confusion. I by no means think these issues are specific to North Carolina. But North Carolina has some of the most high-profile instances. After the film makes its world premiere at full frame on Sunday afternoon, DeMayer and Capturing the Flag, the protagonist, will sit for a moderated conversation. That's the part DeMayer says that she's looking forward to, and to a little nervously also. We really need to understand that there is a role for us to play in this process, people asking themselves, how can I participate? The answer to that question, she says, is to get involved in pro-democracy organizations. But she adds that we need to lead the leaders. For the politicians on Jones Street, it's in their interest to make it difficult for minorities to vote. That's why we see gerrymandering and the efforts to enact voter ID laws. At its core, it's about the consolidation and concentration of power and the fear of what a true democracy would mean for the powerful. So, to convince lawmakers to protect voting rights, she argues, we need to organize to get loud. I learned a lot in the process in a lot of different ways, DeMayer said. The overwhelming takeaway is that we've been really careless with the way we take care of our election process. We really don't invest in the process of elections to the extent that we need to. Now the film True Blood. Skate videos immortalize the physical glory and pain of skateboarding life, leaving docs in Mining the Gap to explain why. I love skateboarding, both the physical feeling and aspects of the culture, and skate videos where the physics and culture collide. These days, the tradition of the sponsored group skates video is under siege by unaffiliated prodigies on Instagram. The skating arms race has accelerated to the point where little kids rip as hard as the teen pros of the 80s. To me, this seems inevitable, but a little sad, because seminal videos form a record of skating's technical and cultural evolution. The pre-Lapsarian Innocence, before Pam Margers and the X Games of the 1987 Bones Brigade classic, The Search for Animal Chin, Margrethe's nihilistic, violent CKY series a decade later, which gave the world Jackass, you're welcome, and the skate mag Transworld's Cool, Artie Rebuttal in Bloom. While some skate videos have stories and expensive production, others are the result of children being turned loose on the streets with cameras and boards to see what happens. These are very special, particular type of documentary, equal parts visual poem, highlighted reel, and advertisement. Real life gets in through the convention of editing bits of spontaneous horseplay between the lines, and tricks are verifiable events in the world. But they are staged over and over to achieve the desired result, and we usually don't see the 50 painful tumbles off the rail. If skate videos are all about enshrining glory, skate documentaries tend to be much bleaker affairs, illuminating the dark backdrop of the joyous oblivion of pushers seek. After all, as much as skating is toward pleasure, it is also away from pain. Some skate docs are about great shakers, skaters. My favorite is Rising Sun, the legend of skateboarder Christian Horseye. which chronicles the rise and fall of the skate artist whose soulful bravado played counterpoint to Tony Hawk's robust precision back in the day. Minding Gap shows the full frame on Saturday is something else again. Minding the Gap is a documentary about a group of average skaters. With the glory stripped away, only the question remains, why did they abuse their bodies by leaping around sharp bits of concrete and metal on finicky wheeled boards? The answer is that it shoots them out of a grim gauntlet of child abuse, racism, parental neglect, and a post-industrial decay. It becomes easy to see why improvised families take shape in such an inhospitable void. For 10 years, the young director, Bing Liu, filmed his friends in Rockford, Illinois, a truly rusty, rust-belt town that they traversed by wooden toy. Their simple ollies and shove-shove-its developed into solid kickflips and airs over the years. Three main characters soon emerged from the scrum. Zach, the film's id, is handsome, charismatic, hedonistic, and we soon gather inexpressibly tortured. But at first, he's all party. "Are you going to put me smoking weed in that thing?" he asked Lou, breathing out fumes. "I've got you free range. I have no stipulation." Then he shotguns a PBR. Zach fights terribly with his baby's mother, but is surprisingly tender with baby. His art, his film most troubling, is about his relationship with the mother. She gets her own art, too. And his fitful attempts to grow up, frequently backsliding and replicating the cycle of abuse he has in common with all of his friends. Here's the film's heart and soul. It's almost the only African-American kid at the skate park. Sweet and self-conscious, radiating an embarrassingly suppressed delight, he finds a kinship among skaters that he doesn't find at home, where he stands out with his tie-dyed T-shirt and electric guitar. But we also see his alienation when his friends repeat or laugh at pop culture racial slurs, and he sometimes destroys decks in anger. When we ask how he is disciplined as a child, he explains mildly, "Well, they call it child abuse now." His arc is getting over his father's death and breaking free from Rockford. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.